Welcome to another episode of Law and Religion Down Under. I'm your host, Jeremy Patrick. Our topic for today is blasphemy, both as a specific legal construct in Australia and then as a broader religious concept worldwide. I'm going to first tell you a little about the last court case involving so-called blasphemous libel that took place in Australia. And then in a few minutes, I'll bring on a guest to talk about blasphemy at the conceptual level, and especially its relationship to art. By way of introduction to the crime of blasphemous libel, I can't help but share that I spent quite literally years of my life studying it. My PhD dissertation was on the history and modern relevance of blasphemous libel in Canada, and some of my very first experience with law and religion issues in Australia was when I undertook some comparative work in that context. Although in the West, we can trace the separation of church and state into the largely secular legal systems we have today, vestiges of that union remained until the very recent past. The idea of a common law crime of blasphemous libel is a perfect example, as the Australian case I'm going to be talking about occurred in 1997. The facts are fascinating. Those of you with an interest in art will likely be familiar with Andre Serrano, an artist of international significance. In 1997, as part of that year's Melbourne Festival, the National Gallery of Victoria planned a public exhibition of Serrano's work. One of the exhibits the gallery planned to display was a photograph of a crucifix taken by Serrano of a beautiful, perhaps even reverent treatment of, in the words of the court, the crucified Christ as if enveloped in a mist which is infused with the colors of a red and gold sunset. But the title of the artwork is Piss Christ, and it's named that because the red and gold mist effect was created by immersing the crucifix in a jar of the artist's own urine. Word of what the gallery is planning to display spread quickly until one individual decided it had to be stopped. The instigator of the court case is a figure that is today known to most Australians, especially those with an interest in law and religion, then Archbishop and now Cardinal of the Catholic Church, George Pell. Pell decided to launch a private prosecution on behalf of his diocese against the gallery for blasphemous libel, with the request that an injunction be issued to prevent Piss Christ from being shown publicly in Victoria. The case was heard before a single judge in the Supreme Court of Victoria, and although the resulting opinion is only a few pages long, it covers a lot of ground. The opinion concisely covers the debate about whether the common law crime of blasphemous libel persisted intact from English common law to modern Victorian law, whether it should have been deemed to lapse through desuetude, whether the artwork should be considered offensive, and much more. Ultimately, the court refused to issue an injunction, stating that at common law, one of the elements of the crime of blasphemous libel was the risk of a breach of the peace or even civil unrest. And that element hadn't been made out by Pell's evidence in the court's opinion. We see in Australia, just like in England, Canada, and the United States, that the idea of punishing blasphemy through the criminal justice system has gradually fallen away to the point that today, it's hard to imagine any court in any of those countries recognizing blasphemous libel as a common law offense. But of course, just because an offense may have lapsed in some countries doesn't mean it has lapsed everywhere in the world, and nor does the importance of a religious concept lose importance simply because it is no longer recognized by the law. Now that I've talked a little about my own interest in the history of the crime of blasphemous libel and summarized the litigation in Victoria over Andre Serrano's work, I'd like to introduce my guest for this episode. Professor Brent Rodriguez-Plate is a professor of religious studies at Hamilton College in upstate New York and executive director of APRIL, the Association for Public Religion and Intellectual Life. He's also editor of the association's prominent 71-year-old journal, Cross Currents. Professor Rodriguez-Plate, who has kindly said I could call him Brent, first came to my attention years ago with his book, Blasphemy, Art That Offends. I referred to it many times while writing my dissertation, and it's a real pleasure to have a conversation with the author about the concept of blasphemy. Brent, thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thanks, Jeremy. Yeah, it's fun to be here, fun to talk with you, and looking forward to the conversation.
So I've been talking a little bit about this crime of blasphemous libel in an old 25-year-old case in Australia that most people, even lawyers, will have forgotten or never have heard of in the first place. I wanted to talk to you about blasphemy sort of as a broader concept and what the meaning of blasphemy is. I think we often in the West think of blasphemy along the lines of, you know, a completely anachronistic historical thing such as witch trials or heresy trials or things like that. Does the concept of blasphemy still have relevance today in helping us understand religion or law or anything along those lines? Or is it a purely historical sort of thing?
Well, it certainly does in in a number of cases, I say up front that I'm not a legal scholar. I'm not a legal expert. My work is really as a religious studies scholar and sort of fancy myself a cultural critic. So when I wrote this book, I started this 20 years ago now. I started writing it. It was published in 2006. And it's, I've kept up on it, but some of the interests have changed a bit, I think, over the years. And I think the idea of blasphemy, I guess in a certain sense, I personally like to see less laws around the world, blasphemy laws. People are killed for freedom of expression, and that's not a good thing. If there were ways to get rid of, more blasphemy laws, that would be great. As you mentioned, sort of in the West, I'm in Spain right now, but usually live in the United States, and, you're in Australia. And I think that some of these nations, we've of course gotten rid of many of the ideas of it. It seems very old fashioned in various ways, but I think there's a broader way to think about blasphemy that can really be useful. I'm actually sort of really interested. Leonard Levy, the legal scholar, wrote quite a bit on blasphemy, and I quoted in my book, but he talks about it as sort of a litmus test of what a society finds valuable in their societies. This is you bump up against certain levels of problems, and I think that's kind of useful kind of idea. I'm not sure if I'd be happy with other words besides blasphemy, but I think it kind of works in the larger sort of conceptual sort of mind frame that, it gets us to the idea that there are limits that we hold, personal limits, cultural limits, societal limits, legal limits. We live by limits all the time. We would die without limits. I was just walking down the street and crossed the road, and someone ran through a red light right as I was about to cross over it. And if we don't respect the limits of a red light, people get killed, right? So it's there. Obviously that's very simplistic, but I think blasphemy sort of is in that realm. I think blasphemy allows us to think about what kind of limits that we do have. What do we think are, and sort of to broaden the thing beyond legal capacities into more cultural dimensions. And I think that's I think it's a useful thing. I think it can be useful. I'm not sure I use it outside of, I'm not sure I'd ever say something is blasphemous, that I have my own limits, but I'm not sure if I said you're going too far, I would call that blasphemous, on a personal level. So it does have a broader social dimension to it that I think is useful.
When we use the word blasphemy or blasphemous in conversation, do you think we're talking about the same thing? This morning I was telling my son I was going to record this interview, and it was about blasphemy, and he's 10 years old, and he said, "What is blasphemy?" And I struggled to give an explanation. I said something about when you say mean things about God or something like that, but obviously a very good definition. In your book, you write a little bit about the difficulty in coming up with a definition of blasphemy. Do you think we can come up with a solid working definition, or is it one of those things like obscenity, the classic phrase, we know it when we see it. What are your thoughts on that?
I struggled a little bit through the book to kind of come up with a with a working definition for the purposes of the book that I wrote. And again, the book was on, was for an arts press in London, Black Dog Arts. So I was really looking at from sort of an art historical perspective and thinking about the power of images, specifically through it. So I was, there's kind of a limitation there. And I get into various legal, the Supreme Court of the UK or the Supreme Court of the US, issues going on, with those countries. But in the end, it was much more of a cultural image, visual culture kind of work. And I think for me, the kind of definition that I come up with and sort of beyond the book is, you know, it's a couple things. For one, as I mentioned before, it's a litmus test, borrowing Leonard Levy's terms. It's a term that lets us know what are the limits that we find acceptable in a society. And every society has these, you know, and we sometimes think, oh yeah, we don't deal with those things anymore. But of course we do, you know, I mean, child pornography, right, is just the most blatant example. There's all kinds of reasons people may or may not call that blasphemous, but it's our limits. You know, we don't, that should not be on the internet. I would defend that in all kinds of ways, but it's a limit we've set. You know, we've sort of allowed pornography to a certain degree, but we're not allowing, you know, it has to be, you have to be a certain age, right? I mean, we've got a limit as to how old you are supposed to be before pornography is okay. I mean, those limits are broken all the time, but, you know, we set limits as groups, as cultures, as societies. So I think there's, you know, I think in that sense, it's useful because it tells us about what are our limits. And by limits, I mean, what it tells us, well, following on Levy's ideas, it tells us what's valuable. What do we hold, you know, as a religious studies scholar, I've said the word sacred, you know, what do we hold sacred? We hold children sacred, you know, in many ways. I think that's a true statement for contemporary life. There's a sense of children should not be exposed to certain things. Children should not have this happen to them. Children, you know, we need to protect children. There's a sacredness in all that. But the second part of, so it's that part, but the second thing I think about a kind of, as a definition, and I've come to think about this more, blasphemy is sort of an event that happens. And rather than I think I started off thinking this thing is blasphemous, you know, because of X, Y, and Z. It has too much sexuality and it has too much, things that we find disgusting in the artwork. And, but it's not about the thing itself is what I keep seeing. It's actually blasphemy is an event. It happens in a context. And, so it needs really three things. I think I talked about a couple of them in the book, but since then I've sort of thought about three things. First of all, it needs a work of art. It needs the thing itself. But secondly, it needs someone who's created that work of art and there are intentions behind that work of art or the thing, whatever it is. And then finally, it needs an accuser. You know, a thing is not blasphemous in and of itself. It has to be accused of being blasphemous. That's kind of a key point that I think we don't maybe think about quite as much, is that it's not blasphemous until someone accuses it of being blasphemous. So putting those kinds of things together, it's an event, it's a perceived mixture, a problematic mixture of the sacred and the profane. But it needs, you know, someone to make it, it needs a thing itself, and it needs someone to accuse it of such.
Okay. That's a really insightful way to think about it, that yes, it's in a context and you need the mixture of the actor and the perceiver and the accuser, as you say. I was just thinking about the example you mentioned of child pornography. I think is an interesting one in that there we can see society condemning it because of the need to protect children, and it's clear what's being protected. When I finished my dissertation, someone gave me a T-shirt that said "Blasphemy is a victimless crime," in the sense of, you know, why do we need to protect God? Who's being harmed by the blasphemous statement? I guess how would you articulate, or maybe how would those who support blasphemy laws, and we know in many Muslim countries there still are laws against blasphemy that have been used regularly. How would it be articulated that blasphemy is a harm?
Well, when I set out to do the book, and I, you know, I still find this, I'm trying to figure out why someone thinks that, you know. I think I'm sort of this, you know, liberal in the sense that I think we need to figure out how to understand each other and get into each other's minds and get in each other's worlds. You know, it's not just the way we think, it's the way we live. It's the images and the people and the culture that we're engaged in that changes who we are. And so I think it's important to understand why someone would think this is blasphemous, such and such, whatever it is, you know, what, and then the, you know, I'm a, you know, scholar by heart. So I, you know, want to investigate these things further and figure out, you know, what is it that makes people upset about this? And, you know, I don't necessarily agree with them. I don't, it's not my world that I live within, but I think it's important to, you know, have a chance to sort of look at, you know, this and say, this group of people finds this important. So what, you know, what can we make about, what can we make of all this? So I think the, you know, again, I sort of, why I sort of have this slightly academic definition of it, you know, here's, it's about a mixture of the, you know, maybe the sacred and the profane, or things that don't belong together. It needs an artist, an artwork, and an accuser. Sort of trying to set up a framework that people might say, hey, okay, I under, you know, here's a way to sort of evaluate this situation. Here's why people might say this is bad. Why, what are the values then that they are holding important to them? And once we sort of see someone else's values, we're like, you know, I think it allows us a little more understanding. Again, we don't have to ultimately agree with them. I mean, you know, an atheist is not going to agree with the Muslim blasphemy laws, since they're blaspheming against God, and an atheist doesn't believe that to exist. So, you know, but nonetheless, what is valuable to a group of people? And of course, it's, you know, I mean, the thing about blasphemy too, it's always, there's always this sense of it's being misdirected. It's not actually about, you know, people aren't out there defending God. You know, that's ultimately probably not what they're doing in many situations. Chrysophiles' Holy Virgin Mary from, you know, painted in the 1996, I think, sort of dated as the artwork. And it comes to, actually it shows in London, and no one says anything in London at the galleries. It comes to New York, and the Rudy Giuliani was then the mayor of New York City. And he, you know, bashes it and says, this is blasphemy and you're desecrating these things. And, you know, it's clearly a political move. You know, he's rallying these sort of conservative forces to go against this kind of thing. So, you know, Giuliani was not defending God in this. He's yes. not defending Jesus or the Holy Virgin Mary. He's defending his right to stay in office. You know,
it's being so used for political purposes.
But yeah, right. So blasphemy is often, you know, there's this kind of sidestepping of what someone is actually protecting in the midst of it. And it's usually, but you know, it's about power and prestige and things like that. So you say we're speaking in the name of God, but actually it's usually something else as well. And again, that's why I think it's sort of an interesting study, because it unpacks so many, you know, there's so many vectors to it. It's politics, it's religion, it's culture, it's you know, it, for me, it's art. I mean, you know, for me, I'm just constantly interested in the artwork and visual culture. So why certain works become blasphemous and other works do not is just kind of a fascinating study.
One of the things I find fascinating too, I guess, with just like with many censorship attempts on other grounds, it often brings a lot more attention to the challenged artwork than would otherwise ever, you know, exist before. I'm not an arts person. I would never have heard probably of Andrea Serrano or you know, Cristofili, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. But I have heard about them only because like the challenge to them and their artwork has become so well-known, or, you know, the Jyllands Posten, I'm probably not pronouncing that correctly either, but the Danish newspaper that published the Muhammad cartoons. It's often the challenge and the outrage that then brings a lot of attention to the artwork that ostensibly those challenging it want suppressed and want it to be, you know, seen far less. So that's always an interesting side effect, an unintended one, I imagine, on that. One of the things that I wanted to ask you about is that you talk a lot about this in the context of art, And I always think about blasphemy, I guess, in the context of written or oral statements, you know, blasphemous libel in the strict sense. What role do you think, do you think there's a distinction between, you know, images and the written word or the spoken word in how powerful blasphemy can be? Or are there other distinctions you think are important to center your work around the art aspect of blasphemy?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. In some ways, the question of words versus images has been central to everything I've done for the last 30 years of my, you know, scholarly life, trying to figure out what is the difference in these things. And, you know, sometimes I get to this point, I think they're just totally separate and totally different registers. And other times I think, well, there's a whole lot of parallels between them. I mean, I think on one hand, just kind of the definition that I, you know, discussed earlier in this idea of, you know, it needs an artist, an artwork, and an accuser. Obviously that's, I think, can be sort of thought about in terms of words as well. There's got to be some words written. Someone has to have written the words, and then someone has to have said, hey, those words are bad. And so, it, you know, similar kind of structure certainly is in place there. And I think, you know, might be a interesting way, because there are many, many words throughout our books of the world that if you actually dug into them and looked at them, people, certainly you could find people to say, hey, that's blasphemous. And yet for whatever reason, it never got noticed. It never got, you know, never got the attention. So, you know, again, but the question is it blasphemous? Well, I would say it's not blasphemous until someone accuses it of being blasphemous. And certainly that's true in a legal sense. It never makes a legal, you know, court case without an accuser. So I think there's that sense, and also the sense of the event of what I call the event of blasphemy, you know, that has to happen within a context. And it's usually sort of behind the times, you know, a book has been published or a statement has been published at a certain point, and it's sometime later that the accusations come around. So there's this sort of time lapse between the two things. So in that sense, I think images and words kind of can work together. On the other hand, you know, we live in a contemporary, you know, whatever, postmodern society. We are bombarded by images in ways that, you know, sort of unforeseen in human history, just the constant, you know, sort of social media and internet, the images that we see just constantly, you know, scrolling on Twitter or Instagram or whatever. It's just, we see so many images that are just kind of out of context for us. And so I think on one hand, the power of images has weakened because of it. We're less shocked by things. We've seen so much now. In fact, I was working on the book on blasphemy, and even since then, I've come across, you know, a number of things, and people send me things all the time. They know I'm interested in blasphemy. So I just, you know, it's crazy the kind of stuff that is out there, you know, that people like. I think sometimes it's artists trying to make it, and they're trying to be provocative. And so they're like, oh, I'm gonna put Jesus on a cross and do all these things, you know, and you know, smear all the stuff, and then it's gonna become shock, and everyone's gonna be amazed and buy my artwork, you know. And of course it doesn't work, because you know, there's gotta be this particular context that the artist can't totally predict what's gonna happen. That's one of the key things. They can try to be provocative. Andre Serrano and Chris Ophelia certainly knows what they're doing, you know, when they're provoking, or the Danish newspaper, Highlands Posten, also knew what they were doing when they were posting these pictures, and hoping to provoke, you know, in a sense. They can't predict how it's going to happen. And that's kind of similar with words. And I don't know, but partly I think, you know, words, so often these words get taken also out of context, right? It's usually just about a phrase or a sentence or something, and it disregards everything around that in the kind of context. That's how the initial controversy comes up, is if I can just pull out, oh, well, he said this, here are the three words said together in these little sound bites. But actually you look at it and it's a little more nuanced oftentimes, you know, there's a larger context for why these words were said the way they were. And obviously that's the place of, well, on one hand, Twitter to suss out the differences in those things, but also the legal realm, right? What is the context for this statement? Why was this said in the way that it was? So there's I think the soundbite is similar to the image in that way. And then it's just kind of a quick thing people can latch onto and say, hey, this is bad. You know, we need to do something.
And we lose all with social media, we lose much of the context when people get very upset about isolated statements and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that, you know, that changes our reactions to it all. But, you know, again, I'm not even sure anymore what the difference in words and images are, you know, as far as their impact culturally, because we, you know, 20 years ago when I first was really out of graduate school and doing a lot of the stuff, I, you know, was saying words, you know, we're living in a world of images and they're just much more powerful than words. But, it, you know, it's not like words have stopped being powerful. I mean, we see this constantly that people get upset at what someone said. And again, it's oftentimes taken out of context. So the words can certainly have power and continue to, and I think will probably for the foreseeable future will continue to have a power. How they affect us emotionally, I think is kind of a long conversation about, you know, the way words affect us and images affect us. I think there's neurological processes that are different in those that are worth pursuing. But, you know, as far as the possibilities of words and images being blasphemous, I think they both certainly can be in the same kind of way.
Well, whether it's words or images, I think one of the things people who perceive something or say something as blasphemous, they'll describe feeling outraged or hurt or saddened or somehow, you know, deeply offended, very deeply, deeply offended, you know, to their core conscience. And I was thinking today, I was looking through your book over lunch at a restaurant, and your book has many full color images of work that has been deemed blasphemous. None of it offended me. Found myself turning some of the pages quickly out of fear that people around me might get offended and I would hurt their feelings. And I was trying to think, you know, how do we, or how should we speak to people who say something we've said or an artwork we've created is blasphemous, not in a sort of legal sense of freedom of expression or the First Amendment or all that sort of, you know, the fundamental right to do it, but more just sort of, you know, humans who care about other humans and want to, you know, try and keep people's feelings from, you know, being hurt if possible. How do we try and, I guess, salvage a good interpersonal relationship when there is someone who says what you've done is blasphemous? How do we, or how can we respond to that?
Yeah, I think that's really, you know, again, it's really important. And, you know, sort of just come back to my liberalish ideas that, you know, fostering good conversation and understanding of each other is important, you know. Of course, but I think that's also to put, I mean, think about the word image kind of thing. The problem with liberalism is it always wants to come back to dialogue. We should just have a conversation about this. And as long as we have the right words, we'll understand each other, which I think I'm liberal enough to want that, but I'm skeptical enough to think that's kind of bullshit, you know, that words really are not at the heart of how we all understand each other, that the way we smell each other, and I've done a lot of work in the senses, and I'm really interested in ways that, you know, taste and touch and hearing and smell construct our worlds, and they construct how we, and therefore they construct how we engage with each other. So I think, you know, trying to figure out that sense of, you know, the sense of disgust, you know, that's in it. Some people are just literally disgusted by this. I mean, they're, you know, and I, you sort of get someone like Chrysophiles, the Holy Virgin Mary, right? So he takes this sort of picture of the Virgin Mary in this sort of blue shawl, and then has a ball of elephant dung you know, sort of fashioned where her breast is. And, you know, it's a very complicated, it's a very thoughtful image and very complicated. He's borrowing on West African cultures, where his ancestors came from. He not from there, but he grew up in the UK, but his ancestors are from West Africa. And he sort of, you know, and it's a very, elephant dung is a very valued thing. It provides heat, you know, you can burn it, you can use it as fertilizer. It has this kind of sacred status to it. I mean, it's really important. It actually shows up in many religious sculptures. The dung has been used in these various sort of power sculptures that are created and used in rituals. So he's really playing with all of that, you know, mixing this sort of West African and this Western European kind of interests and making the controversy there important. But there's but what happened with, you know, the reactions to it with Giuliani and many of the others was that it's a sense of disgust, right? And then the ways the words were used to talk about it, in the newspapers, the sort of conservative newspapers said things like, it's a dung smeared Madonna, right? As if someone just took shit and smeared it all over the Madonna, which is not at all what it is. Or they flung poop at the image, you know, which is, again, not what happened. It's a very carefully placed ball of dung, and it has these kind of meanings to it. So the words change that context, you know, in that way, which I think is interesting. But still the disgust comes from partly the words, the construction of the words, but the construction of the thing itself. And there's something visceral going on, right? It's a very bodily response to these issues that, you know, again, I think we've got to get away from the sense of dialogue. You know, if we just talk to each other, we'll understand it. And, you know, we have to understand this bodily basis for some of this. Disgust is probably the best word to use, you know, in that. Why is someone disgusted by such and such a thing? Why is someone disgusted by, you know, and it's usually around issues of sexuality and or bodily fluids, you know, in some ways, dung, urine, blood, these are the things that, you know, show up again and again in so-called blasphemous artworks. So it's something, again, that doesn't belong there. It's something inside our body that's expelled. We're repelled by, you know, our own feces, our own urine, our own blood. We don't like it. You know, it makes us faint.
Those are quintessentially profane things. So that ties into discussion of the sacred and profane, of taking them with profane things like dung or urine.
And it's, and insides and outsides and these sort of, you know, well, it's okay if it's inside our body, but then it goes, you know, we want blood in our body, but, you know, don't show it to me outside my body. You know, that's, it's interesting sort of human psychological dimension. So it's, again, it's about limits, about, you know, well, here's the limit. My skin is the limit. You know, it's okay inside, it goes outside of my skin. I don't want to see it. That sense, I think, is you know, kind of continues to be important. And to get into, again, back to the original question, the sense of how do we understand others? We need to talk and say, hey, what's valuable to you? But we also have to get at it from a bodily perspective. And that's why I continue to be interested in the arts, is because I think the arts do things to us bodily that we can't quite talk about in words. And to understand other people means we can't just talk to them, means we have to somehow live in their world for a while, you know, sort of maybe a good ethnography in there, but we have to sort of smell the things they're smelling. We have to see the things they're seeing to really come to understand them. And it's a physical, visceral, sensual experience, and not just about, we can't pretend that words are going to just make us understand each other.
That sounds like a very difficult thing to do, to try and understand it from a different perspective like that, if it's so grounded perhaps in a particular culture or history or religion. As outsiders to that, then trying to see it from their point of view is very difficult. Trying to see How Catholics view the Piss Christ, artwork. How Muslims view the Danish Muhammad cartoons. It's hard to try and put yourselves in their shoes. Even as much you want to be compassionate, but it's very hard to do it, I guess.
Yeah. It is. It's a lot of work. It is definitely.
One thing that I want to ask you is, I guess a little bit getting back to the definition of blasphemy. Do you think blasphemy has to have a sort of religious element or connotation to it? One of the things that I read about in your book and that I've talked a little bit about is maybe something along the lines of, we might call it cultural blasphemy or something else like that, where some societies, even in, the very liberal West, with freedom of expression as, a sacred sort of element, there are things that large numbers of people in society would say should be criminalized. And in the United States, for example, it'd be burning the U.S. flag. It's the First Amendment has been held to protect it, but still, if you did a poll, I think you'd find a good majority of people would say it should be outlawed to burn the U.S. flag. A lot of countries in Europe, Germany, for example, have laws against denying the reality of the Holocaust. So there are things that seem sort of sacred in a non-religious sense, but have some sort of parallels to the religiously sacred and what's ostensibly at least protected by blasphemy laws. Do you think those sort of comparisons are useful? How do you view that?
I definitely think they're useful, but again, I think it shows us what is it that we hold valuable in a culture. Even though the word blasphemy may not come up in, say, burning of the U.S. flag, actually there are examples of people saying this is blasphemous, but it's usually not put in those kind of terms. So I think I think there's, again, the sort of concept of blasphemy is kind of important and useful in contemporary life, because there are, we may not consider it blasphemous to use God's name in vain anymore. And yet we do, think, again, burning the U.S. flag, these examples you talked about are somehow the structure of the event is parallel to the way blasphemy has worked. Here's this thing we hold valuable. Here's someone who's, desecrating, literally desecrating, because the example of the flag is actually the word desecration is used often, right, to desacralize it. So it's there is an implicit sense that this is a sacred thing. I think the structure of it is useful, again, because it helps us think about what is valuable to us. It might be the nation, the nation state. I mean, some pundits have sort of said that's the god of modernity, was this modern nation state. And certainly it's true in various ways. I'm looking out my window here and I can see a row of apartments. I'm in Madrid, Spain, and there are Spanish flags hanging off various, not a lot of them, but a handful of Spanish flags hanging off of balconies here. And there's the sense of, this is our nation, this is our place. We're so much important that we're going to put a flag. Nothing else is there, just the flag of Spain, and certainly the same happens in countries all over the place. But this is the symbol of this thing that we hold valuable. If someone came and ripped it down, people would be very upset and maybe get beat up, in it. So I think, again, the structure, and I think it forces, what I'm really interested too is the way it forces sort of a self-reflection. Ultimately I would want to see not just how we understand the other, but also a self-reflection. Well, what is it that I hold valuable? What are my own limits, or what are my cultures? What is my friend groups? Limits, there are, we hold certain things valuable. Again, the issue of child pornography we mentioned earlier. Yes, I'm gonna, defend, I understand the constructions of it, but nonetheless, I'm gonna argue that that's not a good thing, for a number of reasons. Our sense of childhood keeps changing, right? It evolves over time. We've sort of pushed the boundaries. We've invented in the past 100 years, right? We've invented a thing called adolescence and teenagerness that didn't exist. You were just a child, then you became an adult, in earlier societies and many societies around the world continually. We invented this in-between stage. And so there's this ambiguous kind of place, you know, when does a child become an adult? Well, they've got to go through this long adolescent period and they're young adults now. And, you know, it's sort of, you know, with someone who teaches college, and like, yeah, in many ways, my students are adults, you know, they can be tried, they can go to war, they can vote, they can do these various, they can buy cigarettes. But, you know, certain ways in which they don't think of themselves as adults, you know, they understand themselves as, you know, young adults or girls and boys, you know, or, you know, something sort of not quite adult in that. So it's, you know, again, the sense of where is this limit? So what is, you know, exploitation of children, you know, what age is that? Well, you know, so we arbitrarily set, you know, legally, you know, we need to, but, you know, it's like 18. So the day before you're 18, it's illegal. The day after you're 18, it's not, you know, there's this, you know, when you really look at it, it's kind of bizarre. So what is it that I hold value? You know, what is it that I want to defend in my life? And what would I be upset if someone, you know, said something about? I think the contemporary, I was thinking about this actually in terms of the Black Lives Matter movement in the US, and I think it's become fairly global in a lot of ways. There's this, you know, important, I was at a, not long after George Floyd's murder in Minnesota, I went to a rally in the city nearby me. And, you know, we sort of walking down the street and, you know, making our protest songs and things like that. And, you know, people were saying Black Lives Matter. And someone, of course, starts screaming All Lives Matter. And everybody else sort of screams back Black Lives Matter. And then this person saying All Lives Matter. And, you know, so there's this, you know, so it's this important thing. I think right now Black lives are sacred, and we need to have that. So yes, of course, all life is sacred, and you know, these kind of generalized abstract ideas. But right now, it's important to say that that Black lives are sacred. You know, that there's a struggle. This is what, you know, many of us are sort of working towards and struggling for. Is that, you know, right now this is important to separate Black lives, Black bodies out from other lives and sort of say, this matters and this is important. And, you know, this is what we hold sacred right now. And again, this is, of course, it's a construction. Of course, all lives matter ultimately, but right now it's important to say Black lives matter and that Black lives are sacred. So it's, you know, again, this is one of our limits that we're working with in contemporary life. Not everybody agrees.
And that, I guess, points to what you're saying about all these statements, blasphemous artworks or blasphemous words, always appear in a particular context, a political context or a religious context. And I think that All Lives Matter is a really good example. I mean, if 10 years ago someone said All Lives Matter, that would be a perfectly uncontroversial, you know, statement. There's right. No attention whatsoever.
But exactly.
If someone says that, then you know from the context that it's counter-protesting police brutality or saying that whatever it is. And so we know from the context that a very different meaning is being given to that than it would have been, you know, before this context came about. So that's a really good example, I think a useful example. Yeah. You've been very generous with your time. So I'll just wrap up with one or two other questions. I guess to tie things back for our listeners, I do notice that in your book, you have a picture of Serrano's artwork, Piss Christ. What did it? I guess maybe I'd ask, why did you choose to include it in your book? Did it mean anything in particular to you at the time? Do you think it'd still have the same power to shock people if it were in a museum today? What were your thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's an amazing artwork. I've seen it, you know, sort of the actual photographic print of it, and it's really just beautiful. You see it if you see it across the gallery, and you see it. It's this brilliant yellow. It looks very reverent. If you have no idea what it is, and you see it, it's a beautiful picture. You know, it starts with that on a sort of beauty level. It looks great. You know, again, if somehow you can be out of context and not know what it was, you would kind of be drawn to this image. And this is part of the genius of it, and why, you know, again, why I keep coming back to art is because, you know, every once in a while, someone like Chris O'Feely comes along or Serrano comes along and they do these works that, you know, so deftly balance that limit between the sacred and the profane, between, you know, between what's inside and what's outside. And they're able to do this in very, very careful kinds of ways. So Serrano's, you know, of course, then you're looking at it, and then you come up and you look at the picture or you look at the title and it says Piss Christ and you're like, what's that? And then you sort of, once you learn about it, realize the, you know, what's happening with it. You realize there's a, you know, it's a crucifix and a vat of urine, you know, which is just the perfect display of the sacred and the profane, right? This sort of bad mixture of the two. You know, you can't desecrate, you can't desacredize this thing. Never mind that the crucifix, you know, may have been, you know, mass produced in, you know, in China by the tens of thousands, right? It's somehow because of this form, it's a sacred thing. So it has this great way of putting those things together. And then of course it's the context. He created it in 1987. It, you know, I seem to have some, you know, interesting power, but it really wasn't known for 2 years later when it became the subject of the United States Senate controversies over the NEA, the National Endowment for the Arts. Conservative senators at the time were trying to defund the Endowment for the Arts, and they used Serrano and David Voinarovich and Karen Finley, sort of a few other sort of contemporary artists at the time, who they sort of pinpointed and said, look, we're using federal funding to have someone make a picture of Jesus submerged in urine, right? Obviously, this is a bad thing, right? On a Senate floor, and one of the senators rips up a piece of paper or a poster of Piss Christ, and makes his own performance art, you know, in the midst of it, right? So we all remember, you know, or at least some of us do, right? Remember the time when Alphonse D'Amato stood up in the Senate and ripped up an image of Piss Christ. So he makes his own visual image, right, to protest the visual image. It's you know, this is the way images get going. The Buddhas in Bamiyan in Afghanistan, when the Taliban took over and they blew up these images, these massive statues of the Buddha, they announced it ahead of time and made sure everyone was looking, you know, first of all, to make it a visual thing, right? So it's iconoclasm or deconsecration is as visual as the act itself. So these are kind of cool. So I now as far as whether Serrano's Piss Christ would have the same effect today, it's hard to imagine that it would, just because so many of these things have been done now. Someone will come along and something different will happen, or someone will discover something and sort of say, hey, this was a problem, you know, in the past. The big sort of more recently, David Voinarovich is work from the Hide and Seek exhibition in it's called Fire in My Belly. It was just sort of an unfinished work that video piece that Voinarovich never completed before he died, and they re-released it in, when was the controversy? There was 1990. He did it in the 1980s. He died in 1992, and it was in 2010 when the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C. Used a clip of this and put it in there in one of their shows, and it caused all kinds of controversy. So here's this sort of lag time of what is basically 20, almost 25 years, you know, between the time that he made the piece and the time that it was charged as controversial. So, you know, so in other words, you never know what might be blasphemous in the future. It may be something that was done 20 years ago, right? It may be something that's just dug up from the past, and because of current context, it makes sense to criticize this piece in the here and now. So blasphemy is always kind of looking to the past And it's always taking things from the past. It's never in the moment itself. It's never the thing itself. It's always about something that's happened in the past, and sort of, it's a reconstruction of that context. So the accusers are reconstructing the context, and then of course the defenders reconstruct their own context of how this was done. So that to say, I don't think we know what might show up. You know, we'll be surprised, and this is the power of art. Why I keep sort of studying art is this is the thing where we get shocked just when we thought we'd seen it all, something else comes along and makes us kind of interested in all these images again, and it's kind of fun to look at for that way. I apologize to those who are offended by it, but I love the artworks. I love to, you know, keep getting stimulated and surprised by what goes on.
Well, I can tell how interested you are in the subject, as interested as I am. It's great to talk to someone who has the same sort of interest in blasphemy, even though we come from different perspectives. It is just a fascinating topic, and I know we could probably talk for a lot longer, but I better let you go. My last question will be, where can people find more about you? What are you working on currently that people should be interested in?
Yeah, I'm currently writing a book on, it's called The Spiritual Life of Dolls, and sort of a massive kind of a cultural history of the way three-dimensional objects that are sort of human-shaped interact with us. So puppets, marionettes, statues in rituals and things like that, and sort of thinking about the way these objects have taught us how to behave in the world. They teach us gender. They teach us about race. They teach us about ritual. They teach us about love. They teach us about prayer. They teach us how to grieve. Just incredible ways that dolls sort of show up in human life throughout history. So it's kind of been a fun project to work on. So yeah, and you can find, I've got a website, sprintplate.net. And is my website, and I'm working as the executive editor of April, as you said before, the Association for Public Religion and Intellectual Life, and we're at aprilonline.org, and we have a online magazine called The Commons that I've been investing some time in, and we're getting that going this year for sort of a public interest in religion and how we're various places that religion meets public life.
Well, Brent, thanks so much for coming on the episode. I really appreciate it. It was a great discussion. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks, Jeremy. Appreciate your time.
That's it for this episode of Law and Religion Down Under. If you'd like to learn more about the litigation over Piss Christ in Victoria, I'll place some information in the show notes. Thanks again to this episode's guest, Professor Brent Rodriguez-Plate, whose books and work for the Association for Public Religion and Intellectual Life can also be found by following the links in the show notes. I'd also like to draw your attention to a project I've been developing, the New Australian Journal of Law and Religion. To find out more, please visit www.ausjlr.com. Thanks for listening. I'll be back in 2 months with another episode.